Hello, everyone, and welcome into CrushTheStreet.com. I'm Kenneth Amaduri, and I'm joined today with Mark Yusko, the founder, CEO, and chief investment officer of Morgan Creek Capital Management. Today, we're going to be getting his thoughts on the economy, what's going on in the markets. He's an authority and someone that you really want to listen to in times like this, because there's so much going on right now. The economy is so multifaceted, nuanced, with so many different variables that, you know, nobody knows with absolute certainty what is going to happen. But what you can do is be on the certain side of the coin, the likely, the probable side of the coin. And that's my goal. And speaking to guys like Mark is exactly how we go about doing this. So, Mark, thanks for coming on Crush the Street with me today.
No, thanks for having me. And I love the intro there. To me, investing really is all about probabilities and possibilities.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no way to be 100% certain about anything, but you know, if you can be right more times than you're wrong, limit the downside. I mean, that's how you trend higher, and I think that's so important. So, having said that, I'd like to get your thoughts on the overall equity markets. Obviously, things are very volatile, and news today was retail numbers. We saw the biggest drop in more than a decade here in the retail numbers, which kind of shook the markets. We're kind of back up now. But is this just a symptom, a consequence of everything that has been built up over the years with the debt situation, ultra low interest rates, and the inevitability of this 10-year long bull market starting to cycle through now?
Yeah, look, pretty simple, liquidity drives markets and drives economic cycles, and economic cycles have not, contrary to popular belief, been eradicated. And there's this interesting thing about this, the Fed put, and the Fed's got our back. And we heard that when Greenspan was in charge, and then in 2000 to 2002 we had a big bear market, and then we heard it again when Bernanke was in charge, and then we had the global financial crisis in 7 and 8, or into 8 and 9. And now we've heard it with Yellen and Powell, and Yellen got out of there unscathed. Okay, so she escaped without her put expiring worthless like they all do. But liquidity drives these cycles. And we know that the Fed has put a bullet in the forehead of this cycle by raising rates last year. LIBOR went up 300%. That's the main indicator rather than Fed funds. And once that happens, all these things start to cycle down. And we've seen surprise after surprise after surprise that are negative. And those negative surprises today, retail sales, and now they're going to have to revise downward Q4 GDP. And then that's going to have an impact on Q1 GDP. And all these things are indications that the cycle is coming to an end, and it's time to be more defensive.
So, Mark, yeah, that's interesting. And one thing that I want to kind of extract here is, really, no cycles are ever the same. I mean, we're in a new era now in 2019. Technology is, exponentially further than even where we were in 2008 during the last crisis, and, 2001. And obviously, we can go back to 1929 and all the different cycles we've seen up until then. But is there any sort of, are you expecting anything to happen in this cycle that might be different from the older cycles that we've seen?
Yeah, look, you're right. I mean, no cycle's precisely the same, although, Mark Twain has the great line, right? History doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And there are certain aspects of cycles that are consistent and are the same, right? The increase of liquidity causes the expansion. It causes, stock markets to go up and economic vitality to improve. And when you reduce that liquidity and go the other way, when you get into a rate hiking cycle, that slows things down and we get the end of these economic and market cycles. And so you can look back in history and say, well, what are the things that are similar? And valuations today are actually very similar to valuations in 2000 and 1929. And you say, well, that's silly. Why are we comparing it to the two most overvalued periods in history? Well, because we're the second most overvalued we've ever been in history when you look at equity valuations. And that's why I laugh. I was on TV yesterday and somebody said, but Jim Cramer says stocks are cheap. Well, I'm sorry, then he's just wrong, right? The math is that they're wildly overvalued. Now, that doesn't mean they can't get more wildly overvalued, but they're certainly not cheap relative to their history. In fact, they've only been more expensive than today, 2% of all of history. So valuations are really high, looks like 2000 or looks like 1929. Now you look at 2008, you say, well, what about another global financial crisis? No, leverage is not nearly the same as it was back then. And the biggest thing that's different is the central banks took another tool out of their toolbox this time around that they hadn't used for 80 plus years, right? Everybody thinks QE is new. It's not. They used QE in the 30s to try to combat the 29 recession and the collapse in the market. And they kept QE in place for about 6 years, right up through 1937. And then they tried to raise rates from zero all the way to 25 basis points, right? Really big increase. And it turned a garden variety recession at the time into the Great Depression. So I think there are a lot of similarities actually with that 1930s period. You got Trump acting like Smoot and Hawley on trade wars. You got the immigration problems, similar to when we repatriated 500,000 Mexicans back to Mexico back in the 30s. No one ever talks about that. We forced people to march back, some of them U.S. citizens, crazy. So a lot of similarities. I actually see the most similarities, though, from a market perspective to 2000 and now 2001. You know, we had the tech bubble. We had the tech wreck. It started down in 2000, and then there was this big relief rally the last couple weeks of December, just like we saw this year. And remember, 2000 was not that bad a year, only down about 9%. And then we had a big rally in January, and everybody was like, oh, back to normal, return to normal. And that's how bubbles end, is they roll over, and then there's this one last, oh, everything's going back to normal before the big crash. And in 2001, we had three 20% rallies on the way to being down 14% for the year. So think about that. You know, we went up 20% three times, but we went down 30% and we ended up down 14% for the year. And I think the same thing's gonna happen here. We had a shallow recession in 01. I think we'll have a shallow recession here this year. And that sets up the really bad year, which is 2020, when we have the debt crisis.
That's powerful. So, again, it's hard to make different cycles apples to apples. Yep. And one thing that makes, you know, our situation a pear versus other cycles an apple might be that the U.S. isn't in the same position globally than it was 50 years ago, you know, 25 years ago. I mean, people like to point to the 1950s and say, hey, look how great 90% interest rates or 90% taxes worked on everybody. But, you know, when you consider that the U.S. was the only, you know, viable industrial nation at the time and there was no other competition, you know, there was a clear different variable. You try to do that now, I think there'd be a pull of the plug, if you would. So having said that, though, I'm curious what your thoughts are on the U.S. as it's not as much of a global superpower as it's been, you know, decades prior.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a really important point. You know, I talk about this all the time. I call it the killer D's. So you got demographics, you got debt, and you got deflation. So those things are conspiring against the once former superpowers. So the U.S., Europe, and Japan. So Japan was first. Right, they had the oldest population, and they led the downward spiral with bad demographics. You know, too many people turning 65, and it's interesting. You know, when people start turning 65, you know, 10,000 people do every day in the United States, 10,000 people do every day in Europe, and people have been 10,000 every day in Japan for a long time. 65 to 85 year old people, while they're perfectly lovely people, are not very productive, and they don't spend as much. 25 to 45 year old people, again, very lovely people, but they're not very productive and they don't spend a lot. The people who have all the productivity and all the spending capacity are 45 to 65. So when you have a demographic boom of working age population growth in that 45 to 65, you have high GDP growth, you have low unemployment, you have low inflation. And that's what we saw in that boom period from the 80s to 2000, right? All the baby boomers, myself included, started turning, you know, 45. And that's the max consumption in your life, age 46 and a half. So now we're at this point in the U.S. where we are 11 years behind Japan. Japan peaked in 1989. We peaked in 2000. They got their debt downgraded in 1996. We got our downgrade in 2007. So again, 11 years later every time. And all these things happen in this order. And so as demographics continue to get lousy, as debt has piled up, so Japan has the worst debt to GDP. I think one other country is in between, and we're in third place, third from the bottom, right? That's bad. And the interest burden on that debt becomes so onerous that that forces interest rates down in a deflationary environment. So everybody's concerned about, when's inflation coming back? It's not coming back, right? Inflation has been falling in Japan for 26 years. It's going to continue to fall in Europe. It's going to continue to fall in America. And so these superpower nations are now in the, you know, aging part of their cycle. And you've got the emerging markets like China and like others. India is another one. India is a little further behind demographically. But look, the ascendant superpower is China. They are the United States in the 1960s and 70s. And they're going to repeat all the things that we enjoyed over that super period from the 80s to 2000s. So tough.
Mark, question, and I maybe help us understand this a little more. We tend to talk about the baby boomers as having their money, and if they're not spending it directly, that's a problem. But what if it's in the bank account? You know, and banks are lending it, and it's cycling through in a different way. Is that a way to, you know, is that a positive thing for the economy? And what do you expect to happen with the money that the baby boomers have? At what point is it going to start getting transferred from that generation to the millennials, who are a huge part of the population now?
Well, you know, it, again, really important points. And it's interesting, you know, people point to things all the time and forget the other side of the balance sheet. So people look at one side of the balance sheet and say, oh, well, people have all this money saved. Well, actually, they don't, right? Their net position, savings minus debt, is horrible, right? The average person has, you know, sub $100,000 saved for retirement. That isn't going to make it. And the average person couldn't raise $500, I think more than half of America couldn't raise $500 for an emergency. So the average person is not very well off at all. All that wealth that you talk about, the $7 trillion, is concentrated in the hands of a very small number of people, the 1% or even the 0.1%. And so it is sitting in the banks, but the banks aren't lending like they should because there's no demand for credit, because the average person can't start a business. They don't have any equity left in their home. They've taken it all out, cash out refinancings back to crisis level highs. Their credit cards are maxed out. They're spending everything they earn. They haven't had a raise in real terms in 20 plus years. So we have this really bad income inequality problem, this haves and have nots. And again, that's why China's winning, because their savings are in the hands of their consuming class. They don't have a lot of debt. The companies have a lot of debt, but the government owns the bank, so they own both sides of the balance sheet, so they can actually cancel that debt out. The average consumer in China doesn't have a lot of debt. The average consumer in America, hugely overly debt burdened. So all these things conspire against us returning to that superpower, you know, super growth mode. And everyone talks about 3% and 4% GDP growth. They're just smoking crack. It's just not happening.
Mark, so you mentioned deflation as a big theme going forward here. I'm curious what your thoughts are then on precious metals in a deflationary environment, right? I mean, if that's, I assume you're going to say the dollar is going to get stronger here if you're anticipating.
I'll go the exact opposite. I'm a dollar bear. I'm actually of the belief that we're in that very precarious position, again, like the 1930s, where we're going to have to deflate, and that's going to create a spike actually in the value of precious metals as a hedge against the devaluing currency. I think the dollar, like the yen and the euro, is in a secular multi-generational decline. And you can go back for 30 years and the dollar has been weakening. Really, it's been weakening since the Fed was invented in 1913. That's a topic for another day. But systematically, you know, I call it the dictator playbook, right? The dictator playbook is you get power at the top, you isolate all the assets in the hands of the people at the top, and you can go to Venezuela, you can go to Zimbabwe, you can look at Weimar Germany. And once you get the assets at the top, then you hyperinflate the currency and you devalue all the debt and the asset prices go up. So it looks like things are great. Like last year, the best performing stock market in the world was Venezuela. Did you want to have Venezuelan stocks? No, because the Bolivar went to crap. So what you need to do in this type of environment is actually start to hedge against the financial calamity that is continual currency devaluations. I call it the race to the bottom. So precious metals are an interesting hedge. Obviously, Bitcoin and crypto are an interesting hedge. But all these things are going to get increasingly more important. And I don't think we're on the verge of becoming Zimbabwe or Venezuela, but we're headed in that direction. And that's a bad direction to go.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I was just thinking about it. As you said it, the Venezuelan stock market obviously did very well. But in nominal terms, you would have to pay taxes on all that money because let's just say a figure, 1,000, and it goes to 10,000. In nominal terms, I mean, you might have to pay 50% of your gains on nothing.
Right.
For hedging yourself in that situation, which is actually
that's crazy. Really, it's a really interesting phenomenon. And, you know, the illusion of nominal growth is something that people just can't handle. You know, most of us aren't very good at math to begin with. But, you know, if you look at the art market or the collectible car market or the luxury condo market, right, they're just crazy numbers, right? Silly numbers. I mean, you know, Ken Griffin, one of my heroes, and he's actually a friend, a hedge fund manager. He just paid $258 million for a single home. Well, why did he do that? Well, because he's moving assets from fiat, which is a devaluing asset, into real assets, which will appreciate. There'll always be somebody who wants to own the most expensive, you know, condo in the world. Same reason that, you know, athletic franchises go up, right? Why do they go up? Because there's always some billionaire who has a bigger ego than the last billionaire who wants to own it. And they'll pay a silly price. So collectible cars, there'll always be somebody who wants to own that 57 Jag. And those prices go up. But that actually isn't good for you and I, because that means the value of our currency is being diminished. Now, I just came back from lunch, and what used to cost me $5 or $6 3 years ago now costs $11. That's ridiculous. You know, that doesn't get counted in CPI and all these things that are used to tie, you know, Social Security and Medicare and transfer payments. So they're not going to let the CPI go up like normal inflation to the average person. So what they do is they put in something called owner's equivalent rent, which is the rent you charge yourself to rent your house to yourself, which, by the way, you would never raise. So that's been flat while home prices go skyrocketing. Seems kind of crazy. But
so, Mark, you brought up an interesting point, which actually would lend me to want to own stocks. And that is the inevitability of prices going higher. I think it's pretty reasonable to assume that a Big Mac is going to cost more in 10 years than it does today.
Yep.
And for that reason alone, you know, taking out the overvalued prices that, you know, we know are in the stocks priced in at the moment, I mean, just that alone is a reason to own stocks and be part of that increasing rise of inflation. If you know that's
look at 100%, and over the long term, and particularly for younger people listening to this or watching this, you should have the bulk, in fact, all of your assets in equities, real assets, private investments. You should have no cash, no bonds, all of it, right? Because your future earnings are bigger than your current assets. And that's like a fixed income that you'll get over the next 40, 50 years. So in your 401k, in your retirement plan or savings, you should never have low risk assets. You should have high risk, high volatility assets. Now, in the short run, I'll argue against US equities, Japanese equities, European equities, because I think they're egregiously overvalued. And I think as the liquidity contracts in this cycle, they're going to go down. Now, when they're down 40 or 50%, then you can go buy all you want. But over the long term, I agree with you 100%. And that's why I think the biggest mistake young people make with their retirement savings is they're far too conservative. And I actually think it should be against the law to own bonds in a 26-year-old's, you know, 401k. Not until you're like 66 should you own things like bonds.
Sure. Well, I'd like to get your thoughts here on an emerging market, the cannabis sector. What are your thoughts on this? Obviously, there's so many jurisdictions are now coming around to it. And it's like, we're seeing momentum create momentum. in many ways. And, you know, millennials are largely for it. And I think even a lot of baby boomers are coming around to numbers we haven't seen in many years. And just the stigma around it is changing, which I think is creating opportunities. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so look, setting aside any conversation on my personal feelings about it or about its use, which probably are different than my views on the investment opportunity. Look, I think your point is right. The inevitability of the changing views about the industry are the genie's out of the bottle. It's been unleashed. And so there are going to be opportunities. I think part of the challenge, though, is that there's very few legitimate opportunities because there's been so much resistance. You know, banks weren't allowed to bank certain types of companies. And so there's a very small number of investable options. And I think those today are trading at absolutely silly valuations. I think people are going to lose a lot of money. Like if you bought it a year ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago, great. Glory. Hallelujah. But sell. And pay your taxes and be happy. Because I think from here, we're going to have a bust, right? We're going to have this washout and we're going to the trough of despair. Then the real use cases are going to come. And look, there are medicine, there are pharmaceutical use cases that I think are fantastic and create multi-billion dollar businesses. But you know, when you got growers with $10 million of revenue selling $1 billion valuations, run away fast.
Yeah, you know, and I would actually tend to agree with you a lot. The only caveat, and maybe you would agree with this, is I mean, look at a company like Amazon, which, you know, on paper has always been overvalued, but then just continues to do its thing. And, you know, it's never been at any point at a value that you could say, wow, it's a good buy right now. Now, in hindsight, you know, it would have been nice to buy Amazon a long time
ago. You're right. Right? But there's a huge difference in total addressable market, right? The total addressable market for a company like Amazon dwarfs, right, by orders of magnitude, the addressable market of a cannabis or an alcohol or a tobacco. And I would look at it more like something like Altria, right, which is never been a bad time to buy it. All it does is go up because they sell an addictive product that, you know, they have high margins on. And you should buy every dip. But the challenge is that, you know, Amazon has, you know, $300 billion of revenue. So even if they take a very tiny scrape, they can make a lot of money someday. Now, they don't make money right now. In fact, one of my favorite stats is Apple made more in a quarter than Amazon's made in all 20 years of existence. It's just crazy. But they choose to reinvest the capital and build out the system and gain a bigger market share and put other companies out of business. But I think the challenge with companies where it's, look, some of these companies are real companies, they sell real products, but they only have $10, $20, $30 million of revenue. You can't pay $1 billion for a company that in its wildest dreams is going to get to a couple hundred million dollars of revenue. It's just a tough sell. So small cap illiquid stocks tend to be really good investments early if you're fortunate enough. I have this quote on my Twitter feed that on my pinned tweet that says, you know, you make the most money, right? The greatest wealth is created when you believe in something before other people understand it. And so those who believed in cannabis before they thought they could see it getting legalized or see Justin Trudeau make an old country bring it to popularity, those guys are being rewarded. You know, Peter Thiel put a few million dollars in, it's going to take out couple billion. Great. But to buy here now, I just think it's very dangerous.
Yeah, point well taken. And I appreciate that. Another very hot sector, you know, we were fortunate to be in it prior to it getting large masses of media attention is blockchain and cryptocurrency. Yep. And it's been very good to us here at Crush the Street, despite this massive 80% plus correction that we've seen in Bitcoin. But I'm just curious, you know, someone in your position who's in the you know, the heart of the equity market and, you know, helping people preserve their wealth, you know, all the things that you do. What are your thoughts on cryptocurrency, Bitcoin? Is it viable? Do you believe it's going to be around for a while? Do you have any favorite cryptos? And what are your
I am a monster bull. It's here to stay. And you got to separate this, you know, there's a lot of topics here. We got to separate out cryptocurrency from utility tokens, from security tokens. We got to think about Bitcoin versus the others. You know, Bitcoin is king crypto. I think it's going to be the winner take all in the true cryptocurrency store of value, medium of exchange. You know, we just closed a fund last Friday, a venture capital fund, and we invest in the infrastructure around, you know, trading in cryptocurrencies, in building protocols, in developing the infrastructure to make this a real part of the future. And then JP Morgan this morning comes out and says they're going to do a stable coin, JP Morgan coin. Now, I'm not a big fan of bank-sponsored stable coins. I think that's no different than, you know, any other closed-door utilities token, which I think don't have a lot of value. I'm a much bigger believer in what cryptocurrency and decentralized networks bring to mankind. So we could talk all day about how bullish I am about Bitcoin over the long term. And you know, I think it's crazy that people can't separate value from price, right? The price of Bitcoin, you know, 10 years ago was 0.003 cents. And today it's $3,700. It's the best performing asset over the last 10 years, bar none. There's just nothing even close. But people say, oh, but it was 20,000 a year ago. Yeah, and it was overvalued. The price exceeded the inherent value. Today, the price is under the inherent value. And people say, what do you mean? I said, well, the inherent value is based on the Metcalf effect and Metcalf's law and the network effect and how many users. You know, we have 50 million users today, up from, you know, 10 million not that long ago. Every metric of growth of the industry is positive. Number of users, average transaction size, dollar volume, number of nodes, you know, number of transactions, all of that's positive. But we got speculators involved in 2017. They bought what they wished they would have bought. They didn't come in early. They chased the price and they lost a lot of money and they left. That's healthy, actually, because now the builders are back building the infrastructure, building the opportunity, and the long-term opportunity set is massive. You know, I think Ethereum is interesting. I think EOS as an Ethereum killer, there's some arguments to be made about that. You know, Monero and some of the other privacy coins have some use cases. Although I think pure anonymity is tough. I think some anonymity is fine, but pure anonymity is going to be tough, and there'll be people that fight that pretty hard in the real world. So, look, I'm a big believer in picks and shovels right now. You want to own the things that help people develop the infrastructure around crypto and crypto assets. You know, today we have cryptocurrencies and crypto commodities. In the future, we'll have crypto stocks and crypto bonds, and we'll have all crypto assets. And I actually believe every asset of value in the world, everything from real estate to stocks, bonds, you know, private businesses, everything will be tokenized. Everything will be traded in crypto assets. Everything will be traded 24/7. You know, today the New York Stock Exchange is closed more hours than it's open. It's just silly, right? We're a global world. We don't need borders. We need global currency. I think Bitcoin will become that. Will there be others? Maybe. But I think it's, you know, Paul Romer won the Nobel Prize this year. He has something called the Law of Increasing Returns. And what it says is, you know, the technology doesn't have to be the best to win. It just has to get the widest adoption fastest. And clearly, I think Bitcoin has done that.
Yeah, that's powerful. You know, I tend to agree with a lot of what you said there. And essentially everything. I can't even think of anything I disagree with.
That's all right. Great minds think alike, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, hey, I'm got into this because of, you know, protecting my wealth, protecting my freedom. And to me, it took me some time to wrap my mind around this concept that there can be something else that's like gold in a sense that will... Yeah. You know, go up, and you have to take all these things into account. The Metcalf's law, you know, the network continuing to grow, and that's something that you have to, you either believe is going to happen or you don't. And I mean, you know, there's a little leap of faith there that you need to have, or else, you know, Bitcoin would be, you know, valued really $100,000 today because, you know, there would be a clear future for it, and it's people like you who I think can see ahead a little further and anticipate what the human trends are going to be that can position yourselves in ahead of time, which I think is powerful. I'll pass it back to you.
No, I was going to echo your point, right? That I think the biggest problem is people don't understand that this is technology. It's not a thing. It's not a product. It's a technology. It's an operating system. And it follows this 14-year technological cycle that started back in 1950s with the mainframe in 54, the microchip in 68, the personal computer in 82, the internet in 96, the mobile net in 2010, and now what I call the trust net in 2024. And people say, wait a minute, that's like in the future. Yeah, that's exactly the point. We're not even at the beginning of the boom, right? We're pre-internet days when, AOL was a hot thing and we had dial-up modems and Netflix was a bad idea because streaming just wouldn't work and at 56K. So now with broadband ubiquity in your hand and a supercomputer in your hand, in your phone, why even call it a phone, right? It's a supercomputer. That was enabled. And so what I get excited about is the internet was this huge wealth creator and the mobile net was an even bigger wealth creator. And the trust net, and Bitcoin will be at the core of that, along with blockchain technology broadly, will be even bigger. It's the biggest wealth creation opportunity we'll see in our lifetimes, well, until the next cycle.
Powerful. All right. We didn't talk about this at all, but I want to throw it out there as we close out the interview. Machine learning is machine earning. What does that mean to you, and how big of a deal do you think AI is going to be going forward here in the 21st century?
Well, really, really important point. So you said machine learning is machine earning, and that is absolutely true, and machine learning is a big deal. AI, right, and you know this, is not machine learning, right? AI is the most overabused term, right? Microsoft's now got it on their TV ads. No, AI, there's very little. It's like 1 or 2% in existence today. Most of it's machine learning. Machines actually learning from data. True AI means a machine that can think on its own. It doesn't need programming. It doesn't need human intervention. And my eighth grade computer teacher summed it up best. And this is back when computers barely existed. He said a computer is as smart as a screwdriver. And that's true. And AI is the same way. It's as smart as a screwdriver. Now it becomes smarter as it actually evolves on its own, but there's very little true AI today because computing power is just not there. What we do have is a lot of machine learning. We have a lot of things that if you can automate a human process or a repetitive process with a robot or a machine or a computer, that's fantastic. And computing power, machine learning applied to investing, for example, is already a big thing. The quants have had great returns. The problem is, until they get true AI where they can outthink each other, what's happened is that alpha that 10 years ago when the first quants came in was huge has shrunk. An average quant last year lost money. That's an incredible thought when you think about it. They've just competed all the alpha away because, how much faster can you get by moving your computers closer to the exchange? You can pick up another millisecond, but someone else picks up two. So until we get to true AI, true machine thinking, which we're still probably a decade away from in terms of having that be ubiquitous, and we may never get there because people may say, oh, there's too much risk. Again, that's topic for another day, but machine learning is great. It is being used across our industry. AI, big buzzword. It will be really, really important in the future, but be careful. Because most of what people talk about is AI really isn't.
Sure. Well, it's powerful. And, whatever spectrum of AI or machine learning we're talking about, technology is moving ahead.
Yes.
And the question is how, what are humans going to do when you have these replacements more and more efficient, less costly than human labor? And I'm split on my opinions on those things.
Yep.
On one side, it's efficiency. It's just making your life easier in one way. And that's all technology has been for the last, 5,000 years or since the beginning of time. It's just one step closer to greater efficiency.
Yeah.
But then you have the situation where you're going to displace somebody who's been in the workforce for 30 years and is now going to be replaced by a driverless car, let's just say.
I'll give you two quick things and then I'll let you go. So two quick things. So on the driverless car analogy, so yesterday I was in the elevator in New York and it showed that last year 40,000 people were killed in vehicular accidents. So if we could have tomorrow turn a switch and have autonomous vehicles only kill 30,000, wouldn't that be awesome? right? We'd save 10,000 lives. No way people let autonomous vehicles go live if they're going to kill 30,000 people. Yet we'll let human beings kill 40,000 people and not worry about it and think twice about it. So that's one thing that's going to slow that adoption rate that, that people think about. The second point that I think is really critical here is when you think about overall technological innovation and job displacement, this is no different than the Industrial Revolution when everybody thought the machines were going to replace all the workers and no one have any jobs. We have an order of magnitude more jobs today than we did 100 years ago. An order of magnitude, probably two or three orders of magnitude. Why? Because as people are displaced from mechanical, repetitive jobs, they have more time to think. And when people have more time to think, they're creative and they create new businesses and new opportunities and new industries. And we will have more jobs in the future than we have today. We'll have lower unemployment in the future than we have today. We'll have a period where we have to retrain people and rethink how we educate young kids. But the future is made more bright by technology. It's not this dystopian future where we're all displaced by robots. Yet the Super Bowl had, you know, what, five or six robot ads this year? It was hilarious.
Well, that's powerful. I'm going to have some talking points to regurgitate a few times throughout the week and for the next month based on this interview. So, Mark,
all right, great.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. If people want to learn more about you, yep, your website, what you do for people, please let them know where they can go and what they can expect, yep, to find.
Yep. So Morgan Creek Capital Management, we're based here in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and morgancreekfunds.com or morgancreekcap.com. Either website will get you here. You can also follow me at Mark Yusko, MarkYusko, if you're into Twitter. And you can also find us on Google and a whole bunch of other places. But hey, appreciate being on the show. Enjoyed the conversation and look forward to do it again sometime.
And thank you for coming on CrushTheStreet.com.